Hi, everybody. This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Today, the show is being broadcast on August 14th, 2016, the 10th day of Av, 5776. It's been pre-recorded because today I'm probably being very miserable and you wouldn't want to hear from me. It's a fast day to commemorate the 9th of Av and the terrible things that have happened to the Jewish people, too many to list during this interview. Before I start off, because I've got someone waiting on the line that I'm very excited to have online, I just want to thank Ben Bresky and Tabitha Epstein and Jeremy and Ari and everybody else on the station who works so hard to make sure that our voices get out around the globe. So on the line with you right now is Professor Daniel Falk, Professor of Classics and Ancient Mediterranean Studies and the Chaikin Family Chair in Jewish Studies at Penn State University. And even though he's an expert on the Dead Sea Scrolls and has recently been appointed as no less than co-editor of a new 15-volume critical edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I asked Dr. Falk to come on today to talk about something else that he is very, very interested in and which I read an article about, which is what led me to him. Essentially, the genesis of prayer. So, Dr. Falk, thank you so much for joining me here on the Land of Israel.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so the genesis of prayer. I think a lot of people, both Jews and Christians, figure, you know, prayer has been around since there were people and people connecting to God. But the reason that I wanted to talk to you today of all days is because today does commemorate the two temples being destroyed, especially the second temple. When the second temple is destroyed, I'm not so sure that everybody realizes what an enormous event that is, not just physically, but what that does to Judaism itself and even to the viability of there being a Judaism without a temple. So, you know, what is your research, what is your field telling you about this and where prayer goes, where it was before when there's a temple standing and where it is after?
Sure, that's a fantastic question. Certainly, the destruction of the temple, especially the second temple, just had an enormous impact on Judaism. Any threat to the temple, we think of the destruction of the first temple, then we think of Pompey's entrance to the temple in 63 BC, and then also the destruction of the second temple, left huge reverberations. We can see this throughout all the literature, people wrestling with the question, what does this mean? If the temple symbolizes God's presence with the people and God as sovereign, does an attack on the temple, especially a destruction, does that mean that God has been dethroned? So we see this throughout all of the, or a great deal of the literature. On the other hand, it is possible to overemphasize the impact. So we have to be careful. On the one hand, we need to be able to understand the great ramifications of this and the crisis of faith that this caused and how, on the one hand, it did change everything. But on the other hand, it didn't change everything. So what I mean by that is that in scholarly circles, it's been very interesting that there's been a temptation to date everything to every big change to the destruction of the temple, as if mm-hmm. that alone precipitated all these great changes, and certainly with prayer. So one line of a fairly standard position is that the type of prayer that we think of within Judaism, that's basic, where prayer is a service of the heart, an obligation to the community, originated after the destruction of the temple as a substitute for the temple. And certainly we find that perspective in rabbinic literature, but we need to be careful to realize that's a later perspective in terms of justifying a development that actually took a long time and actually started well before. So that's my research has really been into trying to trace those earlier developments, you know, what's happening before that led up to this. I think that there were a lot more precedents to that development of prayer prior to the destruction of the temple that obviously were carried on.
So the second temple is destroyed in the year 70, but that first century is incredibly chaotic. The Romans are coming in. there are different sects of Judaism, the Sadducees, the, you know, the priests in the temple who don't believe in a world to come and were very involved just in the temple worship, and the Pharisees who are mainly the farmers and the simple people and the sages, and the Zealots, and just quite a few, including early Christians. So a lot of the sources that say that we had sacrifices 3 days in the temple, 3 times a day, excuse me, in the temple, and now we have prayer 3 times a day to replace that. Look, anybody who's even superficially familiar with the Bible knows that there's personal prayer way, way back, even before there's a temple, with, let's say, Hannah praying for her son in Shiloh when the tabernacle's up in Shiloh. And, of course, the matriarchs and patriarchs always talking about people were communing with God all the time. So I guess when we're talking about prayer, it's more, as you said, like in a group, either in a church or in a synagogue. In Orthodox Judaism, you have to have a minyan. You even have to have 10 men before a prayer quorum. Does that already start before the temple is destroyed? Like, where does this fit in the timeline? What has your research showed you?
Sure. So let me try to get some perspective on this. And it's sort of hard to separate out different things. So obviously there is prayer that goes way back, and prayer is not a normal thing to Hebrew people. It's not distinctive to them. All peoples in antiquity prayed in some form. What is distinctive is prayer as an obligation of the people, a sort of democratic form of worship. I'll come back to that. But let me phrase it this way. If we start with the Hebrew Bible, one of the things that is very striking is that although we have laws about all sorts of things, we don't have any actual laws about prayer. That didn't seem to be a thing that was necessary. We have all sorts of laws about sacrifice, obviously, and all sorts of ritual things. People certainly prayed, but they prayed when they needed to, when there was a crisis.
Pray for rain if you're a farmer.
Exactly. The birth of a healthy child, you obviously give thanks to God. Deliverance from a drought, but in times of crisis, you cry out to God for an evening. This is personal, but also community. So you have communal fasts. Obviously, if there's a drought, the community is in distress. The community might get together, call a fast. And also national. The nation is invaded or under some national catastrophe. They might call a national fast.
If there's a war afoot or something like that.
But that's sort of ad hoc, but there's no rules for this as a regular obligation of the people.
Which is astonishing, given how many rules and rituals it seems like Judaism has.
Right. So that was never deemed, that was a necessary thing. People certainly prayed, and that sort of came naturally. You did have songs in the temple, which seemed to, at least according to the Book of Chronicles, was ordered. But this is for temple officials, and that's very similar to what you find throughout the ancient world. So that's not novel. That you have temple functionaries, special people whose job it is to sing songs at certain times and so on, and the people basically watch and listen. If we fast forward from the Hebrew Bible, it's rather startling that the Mishnah, which is edited early 3rd century, from the 200 CE, begins rather abruptly with a law about prayer. From what time in the evening must one recite the Shema? And if you go straight from the Hebrew Bible, your head would be spinning. You'd be thinking, I didn't know there was a law that I need to pray, let alone that I needed to pray at certain times, in certain places, with certain words, and so on. There's nothing to prepare you for that. So how do we get from the one to the other? There's obviously been a massive development. This doesn't happen overnight. We continue to see for the following centuries, even the early Talmudic texts are still having anxiety over the whole issue of sort of formulating prayer. But there is a massive development. And there's two broad answers to that. One is to the sort of traditional pious answer, which people might just naturally assume, which is that it went way back. And so the traditional answer within Judaism is it goes back to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And this is referred to in rabbinic literature as the time of the Great Synagogue. That, you know, these, after the destruction of the first temple, after the reconstruction of the second temple, after the return, there was construction of this institution within Judaism to institutionalize prayer to some degree. And then this continued on from there. The primary line taken within scholarship is to note that there's actually no evidence of that whatsoever, of there being institutionalized prayer at that time. There's sort of ad hoc prayer. And to date it after the destruction of the second temple.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the most sharp presentation of this was in a famous debate between Ezra Fleischer and Stefan Reif. And Ezra Fleischer, who's an expert on later Hebrew poetry, argued, and this is actually really important, his argument was based on what is the essential nature of Jewish prayer as we know it. And his answer to that is that it is the idea of prayer as an obligation of the people.
Not individuals.
Not individuals and not, just sort of special officials, but the people as a whole, the congregation as a whole. And he argued that this happened and could only happen, in his judgment, after the destruction of the Second Temple. He argued that it would be seen by people as competing with the temple.
Mm-hmm.
That while there's sacrifice, you don't prayer that type of prayer. That's a rule-based prayer would be in conflict with it. And also driving this is an idea which has really taken root, and I'm sort of surprised that it's taken root as much as it is, given that there's very little evidence for it. And that is the idea that the temple in antiquity was a place of complete silence.
Really?
Sacrifice went on without words and without prayer.
But you have the Levites playing, you know, the chatzot shot, the beautiful
so generally the
trumpets.
Argument,
right. No?
I agree with that. Generally, the idea is that that's separate. You know, that's sort of mm-hmm. outside of the sacrificial area, but the sacrificial area is just action. And this really comes, I think, from a sort of polemical position. We find it in a document known as the Letter of Aristeus, dating from around the 2nd century BC. And we find it in a couple other places as well. But that seems fairly clearly to be to contrast with, worship in other, mm-hmm. Nations.
Could it be for a practical reason that physically after the destruction of the temple, the Jewish people are dispersed? You know, you have a few left in Judea, you have people up in the Galilee and the Golan, but you have now Jews all over the Roman Empire. And in order to keep people still in the program or together, then you, in a sense, have to demand some kind of community togetherness, right? So that they know what's going on and they understand what Judaism is. And what better way to do it than to have people come together to pray? Could it be, does that sound too simple a reason?
No, it doesn't sound too simple. The one issue with it, though, is that the diaspora begins long before that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly all the time of the Second Temple.
Right, the Jews in Babylon, for sure.
You
right.
have the majority of Jews outside the land.
Mm-hmm.
By no means did all people return from Babylon, nor did all people return from Egypt. So particularly Egypt and Babylon were two great centers and probably bigger centers of Jews than the Holy Land.
And there's no evidence of prayer then because they don't have a temple.
Well, so this is very interesting. No, we have no evidence, no certain evidence of institutionalized prayer. What we do have, and this is provocative, but it's hard to know what to do with. We do have institutions, Jewish institutions in Egypt dating from the 3rd century, and we know this primarily through inscriptions, of meeting houses called prosyuke. Now, proseuche is the Greek word for prayer. So it's natural to assume that prayer was a prominent function in these places. And if so, then we have some evidence of, you know, houses for prayer in the third century in Egypt. And that would be our earliest evidence.
Which is interesting because the way that we still call houses of prayer is a Beit Knesset, which doesn't mean house of prayer. It means a house of gathering.
Yeah.
Synagogue also. Right.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So the term, you know, the typical term that we use in Hebrew is for a place of assembly. What's interesting is that, you know, despite that little bit of evidence, all the descriptions we have of what goes on in synagogues focuses on other activities, the reading of Torah, a place for sort of a way house for travelers, you know, meeting, assembly, and that sort of thing. But prayer is never mentioned, which is
more of a community center
quite
than anything else.
More of a community center. Mm-hmm. Now, it's quite likely that, that prayer went on there, but that doesn't seem to have been, you know, necessarily the most prominent thing. And one of our best bits of evidence of this is an inscription found in Jerusalem, known as the Theodotus inscription, which mentions all sorts of activities that take place, but prayer is not mentioned among them.
Mm-hmm. It's found in the city of David, Old Jerusalem. So, you know, I mean, as a guide, I take people all the time, obviously, to Masada and to Herodian and other places. And so it's my understanding that there's somewhere between 10 and 12, depending on your identification, synagogues, if you will, these houses of assembly that existed while the temple was still standing. And then there seems to be a kind of black period during the second century where there aren't any. Maybe the one in Herodian, it's not really clear. And then it picks up again in the third century. So something is going on. And then, as you mentioned, of course, the mission of the oral law, which first talks about the first rule, number one rule is about prayer, about when to say the Shema, the Hero Israel, is redacted at 200. Like there's something, it seems like there's something going on here in the second beginnings of the third century that's causing huge changes and churches as well. There's some domo ecclesias, there's some home churches, but also not anything that you would identify as a church today. So what do you think is happening there? What is shifting in the religious world?
Well, I think that you don't have distinctive architecture. So I think that's the main explanation there. It's only later that you get purpose-built architecture that's associated with these places of assembly. Most scholars who work on this assume that most places of assembly were just in open air or in the house of a wealthy person, et cetera. And we have some evidence for this, you know, just assembly in a square, for example. So probably it has mostly to do with that we just can't locate these places because there's nothing distinctive about it. They don't have any architectural distinctiveness for a place of assembly. They're multi-purpose places.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the most likely.
Could it be because the Romans were at the time, ruling the land of Israel, and they didn't want people praying? They were a pagan society, and so the fear of the Romans, you know, we have so much evidence of Jews living underground in caves and tunnels and real fear of the Romans. Is it possible that there was that aspect also? I guess kind of like you would have had an Inquisition Spain, people did their praying out of sight.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
In the ancient world, it's tempting for us to imagine religious persecution and to explain tensions between people as religious, and that's really a mistake. In the ancient world, generally, people were multi-religious and multicultural. They had no problem with people worshiping another god. In fact, they saw that as a good thing. Mm-hmm. The problem they had with Jews is so the neighbors of Jews, when they have problems with them having to do with religion, it has to do with their perceived non-religiosity. Jews and Christians in the ancient world were the original atheists.
Explain.
Well, atheists were in the ancient world, those who didn't worship all the gods. And those were Jews and Christians who refused to participate in the you know, the worship in the community. We have lots of evidence that Greeks and Romans were perfectly happy with, you know, Jewish and Christian worship. They didn't have a problem with that. In fact, they would participate in it. We have a bunch of inscriptions of non-Jews who paid for the construction of a synagogue or, you know, gave to the Jewish community. So that they saw that as, you know, sort of playing ball, but they expected reciprocation. So what really got them, so I really don't think there's any basis for imagining that non-Jews would take issue with Jews praying. I don't think that's an issue at all.
So it was the monotheistic aspect that bothered them?
Yes, although I don't know that they would necessarily see it or focus on it that way, but more in terms of their not being, you know, socially playing their role.
Right. Like I'm praying to your God, you need to pray to my God, but you're not doing that.
You know,
right.
Being...
be polite. Yeah.
Right. So, but on the other hand, there certainly were times at which both Jews and Christians, and not always at the same time, had reason not to draw attention to themselves. We do have at times when tensions flare up and then gathering houses of the Jews get attacked. But so it works the other way around. They're not attacked because of their religion. Their places of gathering are attacked because of social pressures, and that largely has to do with, you know, economics and politics, and then sometimes those tensions are based on, oh, these people who are different than us aren't doing their part, so maybe they're angry. Some of the gods are being angered at us as a community because of these people in our midst who don't, you know, worship all the gods.
Well, that's
so
really
they can see them as a threat. But where my research goes with this is the one key bit. Which seems to me is the Dead Sea Scrolls, where we do clearly have, before the destruction of the temple, the idea of the obligation of prayer of the community. And we have at least a couple hundred types of prayers in the Dead Sea Scrolls for different occasions, for daily use, days of the week, days of the month, for festival days, for Sabbaths, for purification, for purifications, for exorcisms, all sorts of occasions. We have actually texts of prayers and the obligation of the people to pray. So one of the questions then is this something that only a sect did that was alienated from the temple and so they needed to replace it? Or is this somehow reflective of things that are going on more widely? And to sort of cut to the chase, what I've argued is that I think it is somewhat representative, although I think what we see in this community is a distinctive example and perhaps the first sort of localized movement. And it was a movement, not just one community. So Qumran wasn't the only settlement, just one of many, but a movement that had perhaps already pulled together practices into a comprehensive liturgy. And where did that come from? I don't think it came from the synagogue. So what I argue is that if you look in our source material, and there isn't a lot, but if you look for all of the places that we actually have evidence of people praying together on a daily basis, and I'm not talking festivals, I mean, we've certainly lots of examples of people singing and so on at festivals, but on a daily basis, where do we find evidence of people gathering together on a daily basis to pray? And there is only one place, and that is the temple. So Ben Sira, written around 200 BCE, talks about at the time of incense, all the people gathering and bowing down in prayer. Is anyone telling them to do so? No, I don't think so. We don't have any indication that there's any laws about it, but we have this popular practice of people gathering for prayer. And that seems to have been well, you know, positioned enough that the temple was known as the house of prayer. We get that already in Solomon's dedication in the Book of Kings, the temple called the house of prayer for all peoples. We have in the New Testament, in the Book of Acts, Peter and James going up to the temple at the time of prayer. Again, is this a prescribed time of prayer? No, I don't necessarily think so. But I think that that was very natural for the people to want to accompany the sacrifices with their prayer. Similarly, you know, we certainly know we have the temple singers, and then in the Mishnah it does talk, and this is a bit more problematic perhaps because it's later and it could be a retrojection. We do have a mention of the priests coming out and leading some of the people in prayers. So we do have some bits of indication of, you know, possible settings. I don't think any of this is prescribed, so mm-hmm. I don't think there's laws about this, but I think you have some popular practices developing. And so maybe at among this sectarian movement, which we can, I think, probably safely call Essenes as a name for the movement, whether they called themselves that or not, may have pulled together practices which would have been disparate at the temple. But if you went up to the temple, you would encounter people praying mm-hmm. Whenever you went there. And at festivals, certainly, there would be a lot of prayer going on there. And so maybe they were the first to put together a sort of comprehensive liturgy of the community to do so. But I think you have to find some way of making a connection between what's happening in the sectarian movement and what later happens or we later see in wider Judaism, because there's some similarities, although we don't have any prayers at Qumran that are exactly, you know, the same as, you know, later Jewish prayers. There's some commonality that is just too close to be coincidental.
But what do you think happens 100 years after the temple is destroyed, you know, that second century, that third century, to have it be now so emphasized in the Mishnah and later on in the Talmud? Like, yeah, it almost becomes, to some degree, maybe notwithstanding Torah learning and Shabbat yeah. observance, yeah. like the central theme of Judaism is to pray.
Yes, yes.
Organized prayer.
So I think what you do get is a tendency to ritualize prayer because of the lack of the temple. So I think you do get a transfer of that sort of law-based approach from sacrifice to prayer. But I think that happens gradually, and it's that practice is already there. So this isn't something brand new. So this is where I would differ from Ezra Fleischer. He sees this as a fundamentally new thing from the ground up, mm-hmm. That Rabban Gamaliel invented something radical and completely new, and it all happened in, you know, sort of one cataclysmic kind of right. thing, and it had to be worked out. I have no doubt that some dramatic developments happened, but I think they are trying to steer things that are already happening. So that's a different way of viewing it.
So, Anna, it's kind of a segue. How do you see, though, that prayer remains in Hebrew, even till today? And I know it's something that, for example, the Reform movement has now put a lot of Hebrew back into their prayer. Because most people did not, especially after the destruction, after the dispersion, did not speak Hebrew on a daily right. basis. It would have been Greek and Aramaic. I remember reading a fabulous essay a few years ago that a lot of the Jews who end up in, let's say, you know, in the Roman exile, end up being lost to Judaism because of the language. Because they don't know Hebrew anymore. They're not connected. There's no, as far as I know, there's no rabbis in the Talmud who are outside of the land of Israel and Babylon, of course. You know, so there's no, like, great learning going on. Where do you see, is there a conscious decision that's made to keep it in Hebrew? Or it was just, like, the obvious thing? Has your research taken you down there anywhere?
That's a great question. I've asked myself that question. I can't say that I've really researched that. I've reflected on that.
In your free time, Dr. Fox.
Yeah, it is a topic I want to return to, and I have an idea to do an article on that. I'm just not sure where I can get the evidence that I need. So the curious things are, to flesh out your question, which is an absolutely great and fantastic question, is Aramaic became the dominant first language of Jews in the Second Temple period. As you well know, I'm sure. And we do have some evidence that at least some people prayed in Aramaic. So Jesus' prayers, as they're represented in the New Testament, seem to reflect prayer in Aramaic, although we don't, you know, our evidence there is pretty slender. Mm-hmm. But when we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, although we certainly do have Aramaic texts from Qumran, none of the liturgical prayer texts, and by that I mean prayer texts which are, you know, prescribing prayer to be done on regular occasions, etc., are in Aramaic. They're all Hebrew. That mm-hmm. is very, very interesting, I think. We have literary texts in Aramaic, which include prayers. So they certainly can imagine, you know, someone praying in Aramaic and the prayers in those.
Well, we still have this, like the Kaddish, when someone is saying right. the prayer, you know, for someone who's passed away, that is still an Aramaic prayer.
Yeah. But I think that for the most part, there was a conscious effort to adopt Hebrew as the language of prayer. And I think there's several things that can go into this. One is simply that sort of archaizing. Sort of like how if you're in certain Christian communities, you'll find people who still today will pray in King James English. They don't talk mm-hmm. like that regularly throughout the day, but if they're going to pray, all of a sudden they switch to King James English, as if that's the only type of English that God can understand. So part of that is a sort of natural reflection. There's a sort of a different register, that there's mm-hmm. an appropriate language for this sort of sacred speech.
Well, but maybe because it's the language of the Bible.
Because it's the Bible, the language. And above that, yet, is the idea that Hebrew is the sacred tongue. Mm-hmm. And we certainly get that idea in Rabbinic Judaism, and actually even earlier texts. But there's another factor, and this certainly is at play in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that is the connection with the angels. So in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and also in other early Jewish texts, we very much get the idea that angels pray to God, offer praise to God, and they do so in Hebrew, and that the prayers of the people are joining with the prayers of the angels. We get this enshrined in the Jewish liturgy and the Christian liturgy to this day. Mm-hmm. You know, that joining with the angels and singing that angelic song. So on the one hand, that is a big, you know, riffing off of brief little bits in the Bible, which are written in Hebrew. So it's very natural to think of that as the proper way to sing to God and to try to, you know, join in with that language of the angels. Certainly in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the sectarian texts there, we very strongly get this idea that the people see themselves as an angel-like community, and that in prayer particularly, they join with the angels and become one community with the angels and give expression to their angel-like quality.
Mm-hmm. And then later on in Kabbalistic work, there's this idea that each letter actually is special in the Hebrew yeah. language, and they go on that. Let me ask you, I could talk to you all day, but we can't. What is your personal background? How did you get into this field?
Oh, depending on how far back we go, background. So I initially got into biblical studies because of, you know, my interest in the Bible and from a Christian background. Getting into the Jewish context of this material happened bit by bit by realizing along the way how little I knew about the Jewish context of the New Testament, for example. And in my graduate work, basically completely immersed myself in that sort of world. Spent most of my time working in the synagogue with a very a learned rabbi who helped me a great deal with you know, working through sources and so on. Mm-hmm. And then particularly when I chose a topic for my doctoral research on prayer, and initially that I was conceiving of this very wide early development of prayer, which would be, you know, not just Jewish, but also early Christian prayer. But once I got going and realizing that the Dead Sea Scrolls give us exactly the kind of data that we're otherwise missing, that became more and more focus, and then I just sort of got sucked into viewing that body, but I'm interested much more broadly than simply this one movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are there still much to be discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls with all that has been researched?
Yes. Now everything pretty much has been published. There's little bits of new data, but there's lots of new insights to be gained from going back through the material. There's lots we don't know about it and that we can come to better understanding of, better transcriptions and understandings of the text and understanding the text now in light of having everything, and trying to explain how this is related to what's happening more broadly within Judaism. So it sheds huge light on our understanding of Judaism as a whole, really revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. Do you, has your work made you personally feel differently about prayer in something that is like such a deep human need, perhaps?
Yes, I wouldn't say that studying prayer has made me a better prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe made me more certainly aware of the diversity of prayer and the different ways that it functions and so on. So in terms of it's really opened my mind to resources and how prayer works in communities. But the academic study of something is quite different than the practice of it. Obviously, it can inform, but it is a different it is a different thing. But the coming to terms with the richness of that history has certainly left a huge impact on me in terms of realizing that whatever the sort of rhetoric that any religious community has, and every religious community has this to some degree, that the way we do things is the way we've always done things, etc.
Right. Tradition,
that's just simply not true. In any religious community, all things change. And certainly, even when words stay the same, meanings can change, etc. So coming to terms with that diversity of practice, that development, seeing that dynamic element to the religious life. And so one thing I've tried to do is to more and more in my research is try to come to terms with the sort of holistic nature of the religious life and religious experience of a group rather than just treating little parts. I would say coming from my Christian background, one of the big weaknesses is a tendency to intellectualize. I mean, that's very much a heritage of the Protestant Christian background where faith and religious practice is intellectualized. And so I would say one of the really great things, for me personally, from my studies is coming to realize how false that is, and how limiting that can be. There's a whole lot more to practice than, just a set of ideas. And in fact, the set of ideas are perhaps even the least important part. The practice is much more
from the heart.
Determinative for what. Yeah, and it directs the heart. I mean, there is a connection, and Judaism really does emphasize that. I mean, there's a very deep tradition to that sort of holistic approach.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Daniel Falk. I found this fascinating, and I hope to have you back. Let me know when you're done some more research and we can talk some more, because we could really go into much more depth about this topic. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Eve Harrow from Rejuvenation, and I hope that this gave you some food for thought in many ways. I know for myself, the best prayers that I have tend to be by myself, not even necessarily saying anything, just from my heart directly to where I think it needs to go. And I'm sure I speak for many. So take care, everybody. We'll be back next week. Goodbye for now. This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Radio Network at thelandofisrael.com. Make sure you check out my show every Monday, bringing you the news unfiltered and uncensored, information that you are not getting anywhere else, especially not in the mainstream media.
Israel Uncensored with Josh Haston on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the Land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man, in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There, he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." This fall, during the grape harvest, we have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more, and I hope to see you there.